Weather is.
Any subpopulation of homeless folks, this is what I have.
You're good, don't worry, you're all fine.
Next time, just figure it out. I'm gonna move over to the board right there.
Good morning, everyone. Since it's so quiet, we might as well get started. My name is Bill Knowlton, and I'll always start with introductions from the left.
David Houston, College Avenue.
Erin Johansson, TLCS.
Kathy Crenshaw, Sacramento Housing Lines.
Diane Lampe, Sacramento County Office of Education.
Jason Henry, Veterans Resource Centers of America.
John Foley, Sacramento Self-Help Housing.
Cindy Kavanaugh, Sacramento County.
Ryan Lutheran, Sacramento South.
Joan Burke, Loaves and Fishes.
Hi, Matthew Mickelberg, Newburgh School of Law.
Ben Avey with Sacramento Steps Forward.
Jen Klein with Mercy Housing.
Susan Dalton from Resources.
Ross Law, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Mike Jaffe, Sacramento at Bay Community.
Dr. Michael Yannick, VA Homeless Primary Care.
Sarah Bontrager, City of Elk Grove.
Gabrielle Salazar, Sacramento
Sports. Carolyn Wiley with Homebase.
John Ellis with Homebase.
Christy Gonzalez, WellSpace Health.
Nick Lee, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Julie Gill, Department of Human Assistance.
And last but not least.
Oh, Andrew.
Welcome, everybody. And me. Oh, that has to be. Why don't we start with the minutes?
We have your minutes in your packet and online. We would welcome a motion to accept. We have a first and a second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions because of absence? Motion carries.
Okay. Chair's report. Last meeting, I said that I would provide you with acquaint you with the members of the SSF Board of Directors. and give a list. And then when I went to our website, they are there with full bios. So I decided to save the paper and refer everyone to the website. There are two new members that are not yet up on the website, both from the faith community. Rabbi Mona Alfi from Congregation B'nai Israel, and the very Reverend Dr. Brian Baker from Trinity Cathedral are both joining the board. And that is my report.
I'll keep my comments brief as we've got a full agenda today. We just completed our CAP to CAP trip that's coordinated by the Sacramento Metro Chamber of Commerce. I was joined by partnering COC agencies, Susie Dotson from TAE, and Aaron joined us from TLCS, and then Kate from Lutheran Social Services. And I will tell you that it was great to be able to sit from the national organization and folks at a federal level with a three-county team and experts in all of those fields that touch individuals experiencing homelessness, not only make requests and make case for support, but also show the good work that we're doing here in Sacramento. So it was well received, and I would say, speaking personally, it was the best experience I've had on CAP to CAP. The meetings had the most depth, and the right people in the room having conversations. So there's a follow-up meeting I'd like to have with the members that attended, and then from there we'll report out at our next advisory board meeting.
Any questions for Ryan? Thank you. New business. We would like to welcome Dr. Danek from the Veterans Clinic at Mather, who has a presentation for us. At Loaves and Fishes, we have been very fortunate to have the VA band coming out to do outreach to the veterans in our program, and it's open to anyone on Wednesdays, and we're interested in finding out more.
Thanks a lot. I know that time is short, so just go into it. So 3 years ago, we started a program within homeless primary care over at the VA in Mather to assist homeless veterans. And it started when we kind of like helped the marginally homeless or marginally unstable homeless veterans over at SBRC, or in SCJC here today. And then we moved towards reaching more and more unstable homeless veterans. In places like Loaves and Fishes and Friendship Park, we put our van out there. We started offering homeless veterans our services. We transportation, or VA transport, kind of like followed us out there, and so that the veterans who were getting to know us over at Friendship Park basically could make their way into the medical center where we could offer more services. And as a result, in many ways, the homeless veterans kind of dried up. So we kept on kind of like branching out to reach more and more unstable homeless veterans. If I wasn't here today, I'd be spending the morning with the Sacramento PD, where they take us to the nooks and crannies all around town, along the rivers and the tunnels, to very difficult places like shot spots, where there's a lot of heroin use. Where we try to reach out to homeless veterans who are having significant difficulties and offer our services and move them from, you know, basically a life of significant dysfunction towards one of a lot of, for lack of a better term, meaning and joy. So maybe I'll just kind of like go through my slides here real quick. In this presentation, I'll offer some of our goals and accomplishments. Next slide. So, basically, the reason for this initiative is to reach homeless veterans. Next slide. California has about the largest number of homeless veterans within the states of the United States. Next slide.
within Sacramento, supposedly there's between 2,500 and 5,000 homeless, and about 10% of them are homeless veterans. Next slide. And basically, there are some like unique challenges that homeless veterans offer to the VA system. In general, these folks suffer from problems of significant substance abuse, or else serious mental illness, or a combination of both, represent the vast majority of my patients. There are some folks who, you know, have had some hard luck in their lives in terms of businesses that have gone wrong, family relationships that have gone wrong. But the vast majority are kind of like looking at some significant medical and psychiatric difficulties. Next slide. And added to that is the whole realm of things like PTSD, trauma, that makes this population relatively more at risk, perhaps, than the civilian population. Although, in my opinion, that's rather balanced by the fact that this homeless subpopulation has the greatest deal of support in many ways from organizations like the VA, and maybe passion and desire to help from the population in general. Next slide. This is our team. Started out with these five, and quickly fell off to two. It's me and my medical assistant on the left there, and the other members of the team have kind of like come and gone. Next slide. It's rather difficult work. Basically, the plan was to end veteran homelessness by 2016. That didn't exactly happen, but it was reduced by 33%. Next slide. And there's a lot of reasons to kind of like want to do it in terms of, in many ways, what it means to the VA economically. As with a lot of homeless people, don't have steady care, they go to the emergency room, and emergency room care is a lot more expensive than a doctor's visit. So what we kind of like offer in many ways is for, instead of homeless veterans kind of like making their way to the emergency room, even if they do that, the emergency room basically triages these folks and directs them our way. In many ways, that's a really important kind of like good medical business model for about any medical agency that's out there. Even when I was working for the Indian Health Service, by moving folks from the emergency room when they didn't have when they have non-emergent conditions that wouldn't be reimbursed by insurance, to a primary care setting where they could be treated for their conditions and there was reimbursement, it just makes sense as a medical economic model that keeps things afloat instead of results in many ways healthcare being sunk by the expense that can go along with kind of emergency room based healthcare. Next slide. So it said, we kind of like started on Mondays at SBRC and then Wednesdays at Loaves and Fishes. And like I said, that kind of has switched somewhat as we kind of like continue to make inroads into reaching more and more unstable homeless veteran populations. We still have all these collaborations with SBRC, Loaves and Fishes, and Friendship Park, and rural sites. But like I said, we're working more and more with the Sacramento Police Department to really get into those places where homeless veterans are living very unstable lives, as well as now we're kind of like moving towards getting into the gangs, getting into the jails, where a lot of homeless veterans have been stuck in a vicious cycle of gangs, gang violence, and all that kind of activity to try to make a difference in their lives there. Next slide. And this is something I just wanted to offer because I think this goes part and parcel with being about the most important thing that we can do with our homeless veterans and that is move them towards meaningful work. Basically, there is a housing first philosophy when it comes to helping our homeless veterans. Basically, as well as attending to their medical needs, like I said, the vast majority of my patients suffer from problems of serious mental illness and substance abuse. There's getting them housed and putting them in a stable place where those difficulties can be attended to in a stable kind of way. I can't tell you, it's rather interesting what my colleagues in like Ellica have to do when it comes to reaching the homeless of their population. It's not as easy. I mean, whereas, you know, I come and I meet my homeless veterans on the outside and I offer them all kinds of services within the medical center with transportation that can get them to the medical center and then all kinds of services available in one place. My colleagues who are kind of like attending to the general homeless don't quite have those resources, and it makes it really difficult when it's kind of like, okay, we're going to, you know, try to give you some medicine here to attend to your medical conditions, congestive heart failure, diabetes, whatever it is, and we want you to go to the lab about a mile west and then get an x-ray a couple miles east and then maybe make a call to the folks at Sacramento Step Boards who will then connect you, hopefully, with folks in social services to get you housing. It's just, unfortunately, a siloed approach that doesn't offer the kind of continuity of care and unsiloed approach that the VA offers. And along with all of that in terms of medical and social services and housing and psychiatric and all the specialty services that we can give over at the Sacramento Medical Center is, next slide, stuff within the realm of helping with employment. This just kind of like shows that our homeless veterans are making their way towards work, even those within the HUD-BASH program, this coupling of I'm forgetting what HUD stands for. Thank you. Combined with the VA to provide housing for homeless veterans, an excellent program. Our excellent social workers are still working with these folks, who, even though it isn't a matter of a requirement of that program, can move them towards employment, and our social service folks typically do. In addition, we have a work program called Compensated Work Therapy, which moves the veterans towards employment as well, taking folks who haven't worked for years, giving them jobs, typically within the VA Medical Center, in our different services, janitorial service, maintenance services, getting them work, as well as working with them to develop resumes and requiring them to kind of be looking for jobs as they go through this training over the course of 6 months, with the ultimate goal that these are folks who are going to enter the workforce, which I think is really important in every kind of way in terms of meaningful work for folks who have, you know, kind of moved from a significantly difficult, dysfunctional life towards one that has a lot of function. And in general, just seeing my guys, it really adds to their lives. I don't know one of them who doesn't appreciate working within and making money and being able to do the things they want to do with that money that haven't kind of like felt glad to go down that road. And in general, we just have excellent results where that's concerned for the homeless veterans that have been in our program. So I guess for the most part, you know, that's kind of what I wanted to say. I know that the mayor's office has efforts when it comes to Sutter's Health. in my mind, I hope that goes forward in a way that will be something like RDA program. I mean, I just see it as a win-win to kind of like put forward a model like what we have. I mean, I don't know. I haven't talked to the folks in Sutter South directly. But it would seem to me that if you establish something in a clinic like ours, and you can move homeless folks in your emergency room towards a primary care setting, you are going to get better reimbursement and less bad debt. And like me, if you can move people, you know, if you can kind of like watch your people as they enter something of a work therapy program within a medical center, you can help facilitate their efforts. For me, it's kind of like when my guys are working in a janitorial service or other services, and they're having physical, mental difficulties. They come to me, and I address those difficulties, and we keep on moving them in that kind of forward direction towards changing their lives. The other thing that I kind of like think of when I think of the challenges that you folks all have with regards to the homeless population that you serve is just that feeling like, we're on, for me, I'll just tell you, where I come from in terms of medical development and arriving at where I am. I worked in Tennessee when it came to TennCare, and then I worked with the Tennessee Health Department, serving underserved folks. I went to urban centers and federally qualified health centers, helping underserved folks. And then I went to the Indian Health Service, serving Native peoples. And the thing that was so difficult in all those other positions was the lack of resources in many ways. And for me, it's kind of like compared to those other places where I work, I walk into Disneyland every day. Those are, the services that I have to offer this population. It is just wonderful. And we do watch these folks build a life. And, for me, I make it a significant point that, I'm not looking to kind of like move folks towards, I'm just going to say it, things like disability. I'm looking to kind of like move folks towards meaningful work. I get folks ask me all the time, I can't work, and you got all these disability papers for me, blah, blah, blah. It's kind of like, well, look, this disability, form says, this, that, and this. And if you can do this, and, I can't say you can't, then we got to, try something else besides me signing off on your government assistance and disability. And so I think it's really important for there to kind of like be a piece in all of this that really directs folks towards meaningful work. And once again, when I kind of like imagine what you folks are dealing with, I just think to myself, gosh, you folks have to, build plans that are even better than our plans, because I think the challenges for the general homeless population are significantly more than for the veteran population, which has significant support both at the standpoint from an agency with significant funding and from a standpoint of just that kind of feeling of wanting to help, veterans, homeless veterans that comes from the populace in general. And, if I can offer any kind of ideas I can, I kind of like offered all kinds of suggestions to the mayor's office. And at this point, I'll open it up to any questions if there's time for that.
Thank you. I sort of heard that you might be looking for underserved veterans, that you're reaching out in new ways, and I think this is a really great group to do that with.
There are a number of outreach programs that you could, if you haven't already, and I just wasn't clear, you mentioned one or two. In fact, Mike recently, Jasky recently shared with me the whole gamut of navigation programs, which probably needs to be updated. But there is a quite a large web of people reaching out in those areas. In fact, you may have veteran status on the community queue. So I don't know if I heard that right, but I just wanted to say there are programs within the other cities, within the county, throughout the county. We have plenty of hard-to-serve veterans if they're not connected already.
Yeah, sounds good. In terms of my outreach efforts of late, it's been to the most unstable homeless veteran population that I can kind of like find. Guys in really dire need, like who I'm going out with the Sacramento Police Department meeting, and now with our efforts to kind of like get to homeless veterans in the jails.
Right, I'm just saying there's much broader, so we have those connections countywide.
My name's Martin Ross. I'm the captain of the Salvation Army, and we have one of our companies downtown at Center Holt Shelter. We're just 30 beds, so that are dedicated to veterans. And I just worked with one gentleman at Men's Camp, and he had a lot of electrical background. But as I was observing him, they're all in stable environments. But I really liked your idea with respect to the workforce development, and I didn't know you guys had a program. I was looking at the brochure and didn't identify that, but I wrote it down. But this was, when I started talking about some of the things we're working on, he got very excited about it. So I would want to encourage, or maybe we can talk at some point, so we have 30 people that are stabilized, they're ready to go to work.
Yeah.
And but I could tell that he has some mental issue, but he was working on himself. He did it himself. It's over and not using things for probably a couple of years, but he still has some issues, but he wants to work.
Yeah, at this point, we're going out to the Salvation Army every other Monday.
On Monday?
To serve the homeless veterans out there. And in terms of like thinking about it and folks in the shelters, I've literally had some of our homeless veterans who kind of like left homelessness and literally kind of like worked with us think about all kinds of proposals about how it is that we can kind of like reach the homeless veterans in the shelters. It's kind of like at the Salvation Army and some other shelters, although this has changed quite a bit, the folks in these places are asked to leave in the morning and basically attend to their own needs and come back in the afternoon. It's kind of like one of our former homeless veterans kind of like literally proposed something of a grant so as to pick up homeless veterans, create a system with a park system, and perhaps do something in a CC kind of way from the Depression era to kind of like beautify America. And so they're kind of like those ideas as well. So we work with groups like the farm coalitions. We work with the Employment Development Division of the state to kind of like try to help move folks towards meaningful work. The CWT thing is the thing. The Compensated Work Therapy program is the one that I like the most, because it gets folks right into the medical center so that I can help them should they have any medical or psychiatric issues as they're kind of like moving beyond the dysfunction of their lives into a more functional state. But the truth is that this program is filled. There's even a long waiting list for it. And with unfortunate budget cuts that have had to happen with the Sacramento VA, because of the expanded choice program, the program has been filled and hasn't been able to expand yet, but hopefully that will happen.
Who is the contact for the work?
Compensated work therapy?
Oh, just any of those programs to help get better.
Yeah, you could probably contact me. Okay. And I can kind of like direct you with regards to interest in all
of this. What is your email?
I'd be glad to give you the card.
Hi, okay. I'm Bonnie Severs from Volunteers of America. And I apologize for the sentence because I came in 15. There are a couple of homeless veteran reintegration programs in town. And I'm not sure if you're working with those. One of them is located on the campus, at the Maker Community campus, right next to the VA Medical Center. And then we usually have more people there than we can serve, so there would be a great opportunity to collaborate. But in addition to that, all of the health services, kind of the whole person care services that you provide, would be such a nice fit. So I just wanted to put that out there, that there are a couple of other programs in town that are serving homeless, hard to reach veterans that are either impacted or are not offering the breadth of services that you are offering. It would be really nice to be able to create a collaboration.
Yeah, I typically go there and talk to Ms. Paytas.
Yes.
So, yeah, I really appreciate all the service that you give our folks. Basically, during this talk, I kind of like focused on that. I kind of like stated that for us, our thrust these days in trying to reach out to the really unstable homeless veterans living on the river and under tunnels and stuff like that. But yeah, all that work has been great that you guys do.
I feel like if I could just, I want to make a point as an advisory board, that we collaborate more in all of our systems, because I'm finding that some of our system, and I'm not suggesting that you're doing this, but this is going to be my pitch, is that some of our systems are a little bit siloed, not on purpose necessarily, but we all have our nose to the, you know, to the grindstone. We don't get kind of look up and see what else is happening. I think we can really leverage our resources together. Veterans' resources are so richly funded in most cases, which is really nice.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to come here today, is to kind of like say I think we have a great model, and if this model can be applied towards the general homeless, you know, I'd like to be able to help with that kind of initiative.
Yes, I have time for probably two more questions. So, Erin and Kathy, I know you had your hand.
You have a really good success rate on getting HUD-VASH recipients to work, and I'm just wondering, at what point do they lose their voucher when their HUD-VASH relationship when they're working?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's kind of like I brought that up with our social worker recently, and he's like, "Here, well, there are exceptions that you can get." And therefore, you know, whereas, you know, our homeless veterans were like, "Oh, I'm afraid that, you know, if I, you know, have this kind of job and I'm making this significant money, then I'm going to lose out on my HUD-VASH housing." And they kind of like said, "No, you know, we can get you these exceptions, blah, blah, blah." So that people have been working and they get to a certain point and they're like, "Here, oh, I'm working, I'm stable, and I want to leave so that I can live somewhere else."
And actually, that is what we actually find, and I know Cheyenne's here, she's actually oversees the VASH program as well. What we are seeing is that when I was looking at the numbers of families leaving the HUD-VASH program, I was like a little alarmed because they were high numbers, and what Cheyenne was telling me is that they are working and that they want to give the HUD-VASH voucher to another homeless veteran.
Very cool.
And they really are conscious about it, which is just wonderful.
Yeah.
And so that's why we're seeing families actually, or individuals leave the program.
And then I just added, so this is funded exclusively from the VA, or how is it funded?
In terms of like
the whole
my
program,
work.
Yes.
In terms of like the work I do within the medical center, yes, you know, that's funded by the VA. In terms of our collaborations, with regards to the EDD, Employment Development Division, Farmers Coalitions. Places in you know, like rural Jackson, you know, they kind of like account for their own funding. So basically, I'm doing kind of like, you know, helping with the medical end, or social workers help with the social end.
So the facilities where people are getting services, if they, you know, to sort of work, that's at a VA center?
Yeah, no question. And as a matter of fact, that's kind of like a nice thing when it comes to programs like the compensated work therapy. Because no matter where these veterans kind of work, all their medical is covered by the VA. So employers don't have to worry about that piece at all, which kind of like makes sense.
And just the one thing you were also talking about, comparing your system to the general system, but, and you talked about transportation being a big issue. And so how have you addressed that? So yeah. You said you can get your people places.
Right.
And how is that, funded? How does that work?
So it's kind of like on days that we do things like we go to the Salvation Army, we go with the driver, so that if a patient has a significant medical issue, we're attending to at the Salvation Army, they can come in with us to the VA. Also, when it came to working with places like Friendship Park and Loaves and Fishes and the Salvation Army, once we kind of like developed a spearhead there and people kind of like got to know us, when we'd come on, say, Monday and Wednesdays, transportation would come like the other days of the week, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So
you coordinate a van program or something on the days that you aren't there.
That's right. So it's 7:45, they're picking up folks at SVRC, at 8 o'clock, they're over picking up folks at Salvation Army and Friendship Park, and driving them around to the medical center at Meter.
And that's paid for, again, by the VA?
That's right.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me so much of your time.
Wonderful presentation. And if you can give contact information to Michelle, she will email it out to everyone on the board.
Great, thank you.
List. Thank you very much. No for competition.
So today we will be going over a few things related to the fiscal year 2017 of the competition, and the bulk of the presentation will be handled by our consultant from Home Base, but I'll just kick it off and give an introduction. We completed a mid-year review process, the first mid-year review process that we've done to test out our renewal scoring bill, and also to generate feedback for our providers and in terms of how they can improve their score. And the information that's most relevant to today's discussion is that the lessons learned regarding the tool and how it worked have been integrated into an updated version of the Renewal Project Scoring Tool, which the Performance Review Committee did approve at their session last week. And you'll be asked to approve both that tool and the new project scoring tool today. I will let you know that there is still one pending item that is needed to fully complete the tool. However, we're asking you to approve them today in the event that, to note the drop, we're not stuck without a tool. So I would say that the tool is very nearly done, and we can discuss that further when we get to the particular questions. But the item for particular questions impacted by the fact that our gaps analysis is not yet complete. I am working furiously with APT Associates to get that done, and I think it will be a really good product for us to use both for the tools and then also as an advisory board for quite a bit of other assessments and work. So with that bit of background, I will go ahead and ask Carolyn and John to present on the mid-year review and then present the tools.
All right, great. So in your packet, you have a sheet like this. It says advisory board report, and it talks a little bit about the mid-year. So I'll just talk a little bit more about that, kind of jumping off where Michelle started, and then Don will take you through the scoring tools, which you've already kind of looked at the renewal one once before, but as we said, we integrated some changes after doing the mid-year. So just a little report on the mid-year review and rank process. We came and talked to you about it before, and again, just to refresh, I'm Carolyn Wiley, and I lead the team now for Home Base here, so it's a pleasure to be here. It's my first time, so I'm happy to meet all of you that I haven't already had the opportunity to meet, and I get to know you better. You've seen John before, and Jason and Bridget, those are some of our team that work with you, so we are happy to have that opportunity. As a reminder, the mid-year review and rank, we are due for two purposes. One, it's a monitoring process. It lets everyone know, how am I doing relative to this scoring tool? and gives people some information that lets them know, you know, is there, are there things I need to improve? Particularly, you know, each year after the NOFA, then we kind of retool the scoring tool. And then that gives folks in the mid-year an opportunity to know how they're doing relative to that, and then gives them some time to improve on any areas that they need. If they need technical assistance, it gives them the availability to have that. This time it was obviously fairly close to the NOFA because we really revamped the scoring tool and took our time to do that. But in the future, we'll hold it closer to after the end of the NOFA, so more in the middle, and there'll be several months for folks to make any changes that they need to do. So that's just for the future. We did have two meetings with the executive directors and program staff from each of the programs who were invited to that, where we met with them on April 21st and 28th to sort of debrief about that process and hear feedback about, you know, the scoring tools, about the process of the information that we gathered for that mid-year process, and got some really great feedback about ways that we could improve the timing of it, ways that we could improve in the way that we gather, allowing for more feedback to be presented to the panel, and then actually on the tools themselves. And then all of that feedback was relayed in kind of a crosswalk to the tool, to the performance review committee, so that they could, you know, take that into account in sort of the final process. And then we're also integrating a lot of the comments that related more to our database that we used and to the process, and making sure that we take account of all of those things. So for those of you who are here and participated in giving us all that feedback, we appreciate it, and it is being taken into account. So that's kind of some of the mid-year report and the process we've done since then. If you turn the page on that handout that I'm referring to there, you'll see the ranked list that came out of the mid-year. And again, you know, I'll caution you that this is the first time we were doing it. It was a scoring tool that has been changed around some since then. And, you know, some of the things I think that we worked out on how to change a little bit would affect this. So, you know, this is a mid-year. I think we'll see things change after we do the actual one. But, you know, we did produce a list. It does help people know, you know, some relative things, and then taking into account, you know, how we do it next time. So that's what would be produced any time after a mid-year. It gives people the ability to sort of see. It also is colored because there's some trends. The colors represent project types. So the green are permanent housing, permanent supportive housing. The blue ones are your rapid rehousing, and the orange or pink, whatever you want to call it, is the transitional housing. And so that just kind of was, I did the colors prior to actually even doing the rank order. And that just kind of highlight a little bit that the rapid housing are towards the bottom. So if you turn the page over here, it identified out of the mid-year some just general areas of improvement. And I just want to note that not every project needed these. These are just some, if we were going to kind of aggregate what we saw as some things that were a little bit striking. Again, the top one is that rapid rehousing all seem to be struggling to some degree. But again, we talked a lot about that, and these are fairly new programs, new project type, and so ramping up seems to be a part of that. Another thing is that they weren't having the same struggle. It seemed to be two different ones. In general, some of the rapid rehousing are able to successfully place clients into permanent housing, but they're having extremely long average lengths of stay. And one of the reasons seemed to be that some of them had transitioned from being transitional housing into rapid rehousing. And so kind of retooling that model is something that they're going to get some technical assistance on, and that's already in the works. And then some of the other rapid rehousing projects had a little bit of the opposite effect, where they had really short lengths of stay but weren't as effective getting people into permanent housing. So those are just kind of the things that we noticed with the rapid rehousing from this, and that really pointed to maybe needing some additional technical assistance and working together to kind of make sure you're standardizing the way that you're doing that. And that's already underway. So again, that's, but when you see those trends, it's really good in a mid-year to be able to help point out some things that you want to do prior to the competition. The other thing were agency programs and budgets. The panel felt they weren't getting adequate budget information to necessarily make the effective rankings that they wanted. So we want to standardize how we're gathering that information. And particularly in cases where clients are being served by two different projects, maybe one doing the housing and one doing the services. We want to ensure that we're gathering that information and presenting that whole picture to the panel.
Do you want questions as you go along, or do you want us to hold them?
I'm happy to take questions if they there are some now.
Okay. I just got a clarifying question. Mm-hmm. How do you have a short length of stay but not into permanent housing? Do you reward short length of stay even if it's not to permanent housing? I don't understand that one.
So I think what we were seeing in a rapid housing project where they had a 3 month length of stay, but then the people weren't connected to permanent housing, so the exit wasn't into permanent housing.
And to talk
length
about
of stay into what?
Length of stay, utilizing the rapid housing voucher, so rental assistance.
So okay, it seems so, like yeah.
And in talking about the actual scoring tool and the renewal scoring tool, which we'll talk about in just a moment here, it actually does break that down in terms of length of stay and where the exit location was for transitional housing and rapid rehousing. And that's a total of 20 points that's split into two 10-point categories. And then that matches with the 20 points that's awarded to permanent supportive housing. So I can get into that a little bit. To answer your question directly,
right,
you would, if you had a very short length of stay, you could get a full 10 points for that as a wrap rehousing project. But then if there were high exits to not permanent housing, so back into homelessness, you'd receive 0 points. So for a 20-point factor, you'd only receive 10 points.
Can I clarify? I think the question Cindy's asking is a little more nuanced. I think what we saw is that we had programs that had a huge number of people enrolled in the program, and many of them were never actually housed, and so their exit was to non-permanent housing. And then those who were housed in rapid rehousing had shorter lengths of stay. So it's not that people were being housed and then exited to the streets, it's that they never were housed.
No, I understand that. Okay. I just think I don't think it's a 10 plus 10. I think it's like, anyway, that's the tool, so.
I actually meant to point this out at the beginning. Emily Halcon and Sarah are members of your performance review committee.
And Catherine.
And Catherine. So but they've been involved in the whole process.
Any other questions? Okay. So that was an issue, was how to measure it is maybe something you want to look at. But that pointed out that we're kind of having two separate issues with different rapid housing programs, but that's something that Sacramento's Forward is wanting to help them with. So, and then, I guess I said, not getting enough budget information. And then the third one was legacy clients in programs who were not homeless at entry. And I think in some programs that was an issue where it was before they took over the program. In some cases, it had to do with us needing to find a way to more refine a database system, because sometimes it had to do with transfers in family, within a family. So family composition is what changed, and that's why the person is not homeless, but they're now in the program. But in some cases, it is the fact that they do now have people in a HUD program who are not eligible to be in that HUD program. So that is a situation where they're going to work closely with your collaborative applicant to figure out what to do about that, and whether that those folks need to be exited, and what steps need to be taken there. So
would that include folks that were entered according to HUD's old definition? Yeah. So people with disabilities that were entered the program 10 years ago?
Right. So that's where I think that's a question for Sacramento is Forward to work with the program and your field reps and your HUD rep and find out what their position is going to be on that and what to do about that. So I think that's just highlighted that that is an issue.
I guess what I heard you say is work with Sacramento Steps Forward to exit those people, and that is not possible in a lot of cases.
Right, if necessary. Okay. And again, that's for
right.
So you to decide how to approach that or not, and then us to design the tool around how to recognize that depending on your decisions.
Okay, thank you.
And I think that's a really, we have a lot of people who are in some of these permanent, long-term permanent supported housing programs that wouldn't qualify today.
Right.
But when some of our permanent supported housing programs have had people in them for 10, 12, 15 years, mm-hmm. which is a good thing, right? But not necessarily if you're trying to align them with today's standards. So there are program closures that happen as a result of exactly what Aaron's talking about. And I think we do need to have more of a discussion. If it hasn't already happened, maybe you already decided this at this committee, but or this board. is, how, you know, where do we fall on that? Because there have been some programs that have already been closed as a result of that exact issue. And that may have been the way that we want to do it, but I think it definitely need to be more intentional about that conversation.
Yeah, so I think that there just needs to be a, you know, a policy decision and potentially talking with HUD about it and just making sure that that's settled, and then we can build the tool to recognize whatever your, you know, program and system level decisions are on that, so that you're not being penalized for that, you know, because I think right now the tool just can see that they're not eligible by the current definition and was giving some penalties based on that.
Cindy, so just to clarify, I'm sorry for being really confused. The way it's worded here is they were not homeless at the, by the definition at the time they entered. It would be highly unusual to punish someone for not meeting a new definition for an existing tenant. So are you really saying that might be possible that...
There's a couple of situations that were going on. Some, it's current that they were entering and weren't eligible,
sure,
but that was because
of,
you know, family or transition, those sorts of things. And then there were some situations where they entered long ago, you know, and determining that when they entered and whether they were and all of that is a fairly complex thing, and something.
But you're not applying the new definition. You're just trying to confirm they were not eligible at the time they entered.
No, the new definition is being applied, at least in several cases that I've experienced. So that's the conversation that needs to happen. Is the new definition?
We've seen HUD come down on it in different ways in different communities. And so I think it's just important for you all to have that discussion and then, you know, ensure that...
Right. And at this point, SACMA steps forward in determining the extent of the issue by agency, and then we'll need to understand the context. It's a pretty in-depth process to find out where each program and agency is at on this. And technically... If a person is not eligible for the project, we should be working to exit them, but we also understand that can be a real challenge. So we're really very much at the what is the extent of the problem phase of addressing this.
Yeah. But we will obviously, whatever you figure out and decide, we can build the tool to make sure that you're not receiving any penalty within the current competition for that.
Could we carry on this? In the past, we've sometimes suddenly at the last minute totally panicked. Is this going to affect this year? Are programs that have these legacy folks going to potentially not get any funding because they've got so many legacy people? Is that what you're saying, possibly?
I don't think that that's the issue at all. No.
Okay, well, they did affect at least two programs last year.
Yeah.
So I'm just suggesting, again, I don't want to make anybody else homeless. I don't think it's our job to do that. And that's so we're working in the opposite direction. So we did have some households that we closed the program down for this exact reason. It started like 20 years ago, and most of the people had been there for 15 years. Yes, it's true. They didn't meet the definition of chronic homeless today. But at the time that they entered, they met the definition. So it's an issue. I'm suggesting it's an issue. It has happened. I think it was a similar thing. It was kind of a last-minute panic, and that's why I think it's important to really come up with an intentional policy out of this board and move that forward so that there's no... Because we want to align ourselves with HUD's requirements so that we can score as highly as we can. On the other hand, there are some really nuanced pieces that, you know... We need to consider, and they're coming up as they're coming up. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's like we're in kindergarten. We don't even know what to ask about third grade yet because we're right here in kindergarten. So you know, it is what it is. But it's a good topic.
I think that the starting point for development of an intentional policy is to have the details on what's happening at the program level, so we can start with that, and then you can make an informed.
But Cindy, and then I think I would start at the policy level. What does HUD require in terms of existing tenants and exits? Again, I've been in programs many years. I've never seen we've changed the rules. So this existing client who entered under it correctly is now to be exited. So clarifying that, and then if there is any room, having a policy discussion on that, and then seeing, because obviously everyone's affected. If you're saying you entered under old rules and the rules, everyone's affected. We don't need to look because they all exited under the existing rules. Entered under the existing rules. So I think the policy is really important.
Yeah,
So, but that's why I think you're right that
understanding, you described an experience where in fact the penalty was significant, that the program was shut down, it sounds like, because of the application of a retroactive rule.
Yeah.
And understanding, did that happen from HUD mandates, or was that a COC who were saying we're worried about it? Mm-hmm. To me, that's because I agree, retroactive generally doesn't happen in program functions. But we've got an experience where it actually did happen. So also, as we're looking at the policy, figuring out how did it happen there and what was the driving. Was it a HUD requirement, or what required the loss of your
right, and we need to incorporate that information as well. So. Yeah.
Yeah. Michelle and I can look into this a little further and
yeah.
come back and report.
I mean, I think I'm with Cindy 100% on this, is that if we're talking about approving a tool because the NOFA might drop. And so, if waiting to collect all that information in order to make a decision about it, and then the NOFA drops, will cause us to make a panic decision, as opposed to making a policy decision. And if it turns out that HUD really does want retroactive, then maybe there's an emergency meeting that needs to be called. But at this point in time, we could make a policy decision that says retroactive rules will not be changed. I don't know how to
word
it. Sorry.
Thank you. So, is it so? Michelle and I should look into it further and come report back. Is that the?
I think we need to hear the presentation,
yeah.
And then we can
okay.
Decide what this body wants to do today.
Okay. She'll move on. Okay. So those were kind of the three biggest things that we found kind of coming out of it for general improvements. In terms of process enhancements, if you look on the back, we'll give folks more time to review what's called Presto Report. That's our database that we use to take all the information gathered. There was a real crunch on this particular mid-year review, because we had to get it done in a certain amount of time. But within the competition, we'll give folks up to 2 weeks to review their Presto data. So hopefully that should alleviate that pressure and give people time to review it, get back to us if there's need to be changed, then we get it back to them and they can review. So I think that will really be better and alleviate some of the issues that came up. Also giving more time for them to review their APRs, which is their annual performance report that contains the data that they put in HMIS and is a summary of that. And then if they need to make any changes within HMIS. And then the refined community needs and federal priority scoring factors. So John's going to go over that in a minute. But that was the one scoring factor in the tool that was the most contentious, and when we presented it here to you, we identified that no one was really happy with that factor, and that it was kind of a compromise test run, and I think we found as we used it that it was exactly as expected, that it really didn't function in the way that we would want it to. So that's the one factor that we've left out of this tool, because we want to base it on the needs data and the gaps analysis, and so that factor really is representative of the true needs in the community, as opposed to kind of just a guesstimate or just a gimme points kind of that go to all populations. So that is one thing that everyone kind of had comments on, including the performance review committee and all the providers as well. So that is being left out of the tool for both the new and renewal. And hopefully at their next meeting, they're able to take that data and look at it, and then they'll put one in that they feel is representative of the data. So we bring that back to your next meeting. But the rest of the tool has had the integration of any suggestions in it, and I'll let John then share that with you. And you have those in your packet. They're blue and yellow.
Great. So,
John, before you go ahead, we have one more question. Mike, you had a question on this section.
On this whole issue of formerly eligible but apparently not eligible, two things. The number of them involved, or the percentage, is obviously important, but also how they're distributed. Are they concentrated in a few particular programs, or are they generally distributed about? And is there something about the design of one of those programs or projects that caused them to be concentrated there. But for all, you know, well-intentioned purposes, just so happened that they become more susceptible to that, this issue. Those things are really critical about how to modify the scoring tool. It's a little bit everywhere or concentrated, that obviously has a big difference.
Michelle, you indicated you're trying to gather that data. Do you know how soon you will have that?
I will have it for your next meeting, since we have to revisit the tool no matter what. Let's keep going. And when we get to this question in the renewal tool, that will be a time to revisit the entries from homelessness question right then, because I was just reading it. It was helpful to me to refresh my memory. But
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we're going to take a look at this blue handout for some of you. Unfortunately, we may have run out of copies, so you may not have necessarily a blue handout, but it should say at the top, 2017 Renewal Project Scoring Tool. This tool was previously presented to this board prior to the mid-year review in RANK. So the things in here that say proposed clarifications or changes, they're usually bold. Those are things that have changed since you last visited this, I want to say about 2 months ago. We left all of those kind of track changes comments in there so you could see exactly where changes were made. Starting on the first page, we have a proposed clarification. Originally just said project participates in coordinated entry, added in some language saying that it participates in the design and planning of coordinated entry, giving a little more resolution there. And secondly, the proposed clarification here, we took, the old tool had budget information as a scored category. It was one point as to whether or not you submitted basically a sufficient budget. The Performance Review Committee suggested that we move that to a threshold criteria and just ask if projects have submitted an agency budget that matches with the template that was provided to them as part of what's called the local application or request for information. That is something that will be provided to competition participants, and they'll just fill that out. So that's no longer a scored factor. It's just, did you actually submit that budget? And that's what the threshold factor is. We'll talk about the budgets a little bit more later in the tool.
Is
the first one is housing first, implementing housing first principles is rather generic and broad. Is that then refined in terms of what folks, how they indicate?
Sure. So part of that is going to be addressed in the HEARTH measure that we're still getting those community goals information about and community needs information about. But in terms of the housing first implementation, the panel does review the policies and procedures for the projects and sees if there are categories in there of exiting participants due to high barrier policies such as remaining clean and sober, requiring participation services, things like that, or other barriers to entry. So right now the scoring tool does not have a specific refined, you know, you get 1 point if you don't have X, Y, and Z.
I wasn't asking that. I was just asking, is that standard defined for the applicant so they know what the standard is to ascribe to?
Right.
Because many people think I am or I'm not doing housing first without knowing how it applies to their particular transitional housing or rapid rehousing.
Right. And it's the threshold factor isn't necessarily saying, are you perfectly implementing housing first? It's saying, are you applying housing first principles and working with Sacramento Steps Forward on any perceived deficiencies?
And the definition,
the definition comes from the HUD publications that are put out. So HUD provides notices to all COC funded projects as to what housing first is. But in terms of a breakdown of you must not have X, Y, and Z, or you must have A, B, and C, we don't have that kind of resolution in the scoring tool at this time. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? So is the intent of this, of the threshold factors, to have a first level of either inclusion or elimination of projects? Meaning, if a project meets some of these, would they be eliminated from being scored?
Yes.
So if they didn't meet one of them, or if they didn't meet, like,
The projects would have to meet every single one of these. We do work with projects. All the renewal projects are going to meet these categories because we work with them throughout the year. It's more of a concern for new projects, and the threshold factors are designed on yes or no categories for HUD funding. So if HUD sees that your program is not housing first, they will deny your application on their end. Even if we've prioritized you very high, HUD will come back and say, we're not going to fund this application. It's the same in terms of participation in coordinated entry, HMIS, these are all requirements for your actual HUD-funded grant. So if a project refuses to participate in any one of these, there's a high probability that HUD will come back and say, we refuse to fund this, even if the community wants the project. Yeah.
So going back to the answer you just gave to Cindy's question, I have to admit, I was confused. I do understand that the scoring tool doesn't have that definition, but it was my understanding that the application did have that definitive, so that the application would have those defined principles.
Sure. And
it's not in the scoring tool. So I
guess like a checklist, right?
Yeah, that's what
do you do this, you know, do you clean and sober, yada,
okay,
yada.
I just want to make sure who I heard the answer was a little bit different.
Sure.
No, it's just sort of out here.
Yeah,
the
no, and
it's the application is not. Mm-hmm.
And the eSNAPS application as well that you submit to HUD has a number of categories asking about housing first principles. Sorry, thanks. Thank you for the clarification. Yeah. Moving on to page 2 of the scoring tool.
Just to clarify, though, I mean, the eSNAPS application asks like 4 housing first questions, but that, I mean, I think that your COC is asking for even more than that.
Yes.
Like, I mean, because it doesn't say, well, do your policies not prohibit this, that, or the other thing, and we're looking for even more than that in the policies. So, I think you might want to speak to this a little bit, I would guess.
For the mid-year review, obviously we don't have the benefit of an eSNAPS application to look at, but we did, the staff did review policies and procedures looking for policies that, to say it positively, looking that policies and procedures reflected that programs are low barriers to entry, and that there are steps in place to avoid immediately exiting someone. So those were the main things I was reading for in the policies and procedures. And I will say that for the mid-year on this factor, we did not have any projects that either didn't immediately meet the threshold requirement or just needed a little feedback on adjustments that they needed to make. And that was true across the board in terms of the threshold review. There are a couple projects that need to make a few changes. None that I think will be able to or are already in the process of meeting the requirements now.
For renewals.
Yeah.
And in light of time, if we could hold questions until we get to the end of the tool, that way we can make sure we get through both this and our new scoring tool before 9:30, that would be great. Thanks. Page 2, a clarification there in terms of data quality, added language of that you're complying with the data quality plan by entering at least 95% of demographic data within an average of 3 days or less after client enters. That is directly from the data quality plan.
So I've got to stop you. So
two
questions. I don't know what the word average means. Does that mean I could have 6 days on some and 1 day on the other? Is that what that means?
Correct.
So that's the compromise. Because we had thought we had agreed we were going to do 5 days or 3 work days.
5 working days.
Something like that. And that's what we talked about in this group. And it's not here. And I don't know why it's not here. It's just a HUD requirement that we can't get around something.
No, it's not. It's my understanding this is what was discussed at the Performance Review Committee.
No, I don't have a performance review. I don't sit there. But here, we thought we had a different agreement on what was appropriate and fair.
And at the large meeting we had.
Same conversation.
Yes, we've had this conversation a number of times.
And this was never what we agreed to.
Yeah. I was at the Performance Review Committee. We were told this is what the data plan says, so we don't review the data plan.
That is what the data plan says.
Yeah,
right.
But it's not what I think what John's saying is.
Right, I understand. I'm going to say that this is not. I don't think this is a decision for the Performance Review Committee.
Right. And the HMIS data quality plan can be updated or revised, and we obviously didn't have time to do that presentation today, but we can do it at your next meeting. But I'm saying that I've reviewed what you'd like to see as changes, and they're not consistent. The policies in the plan are consistent with what HUD expects us to do, so we will revisit it. I'm not sure if the change will be made. But you will decide that together.
Well, what does HUD say we have to do?
Yeah. David, timeliness is 3 days, and the clarification of 3 business days, we'll make that in the plan. We don't have to. That was an error, because I think that's an omission. We don't need enough to formally update the plan to say business days, so that clarification will be built into the compliance report.
So 3 business days is okay.
Yes, and we did a training. Our HMIS department did a training on the HUD data quality plan and all of its requirements in December. So every agency should have already received the plan and a training on it, but we will definitely send it out again straight away.
So we just agreed, did we just change this to 3 business days? Is that what we just agreed to?
Yes. Well, the business days is...
That's in the policy currently. Any change would be to expand it beyond that 3 business days, and HUD's best practices are to maintain that 3 business days.
But we just agreed that's what's going to now be said in the
tool.
Yeah, and to clarify, the tool originally said that the programs comply with the data quality plan. So this is basically just taking the language from that data quality plan and actually having it present in the tool so that the panel and agencies are all clear as to what that exactly means.
So you'll add business days so they're clear on it.
Yes, we can put in that business days.
In the tool and in the plan when we resend it out, I'll make sure that business appears in every instance that's mentioned.
Great. And then that bottom one there on page 2, the language in past years has been that the agency has returned less than 10%. That's just been kind of reversed around to say the agency has spent 90% or more of their funding. So it's the same thing, just different languaging. On page 3, this is where I was talking about budgets. In the old tool, there was a score factor on, you know, did you have a budget? Did it comply with the template? There was kind of some more questions about, you know, what did your budget look like? Did we think it was adequate? Did we not? That's all basically been combined into one factor. That's that updated factor that's getting at all that information, but just in a clearer fashion of, you know, is the budget that you presented, adequate to support your project design type? Do you have adequate staff? And are you going to be able to provide the services that you say you're going to be able to provide to the clients that you say you're going to serve? And that's what the panel is reviewing with that scoring factor. As mentioned earlier, that policy priorities factor is to be determined once we have that gaps analysis complete, so that'll be reviewed at the next performance review committee.
I'm sorry, I know you want us to hold that question.
That's all right. I just want to make sure we get through both these tools.
I'm totally aware of that. Sure, not a problem. This question. This updated factor that you just went through on the budget, it says cost-effective way. What does that exactly mean?
Sure. So in the past, we have had sort of a non-scored or sort of a scored factor about what does cost look like. You know, is it within a couple of standard deviations? That was what we did last year. We've found that that factor doesn't give us the resolution we want in terms of cost analyses because it's very hard to compare programs. If you're serving very hard to serve populations, your services budget is probably going to be much higher than a population that has lower barriers in terms of their needs. A good example is, you know, difference between a permanent supportive housing project and a rapid rehousing project. We also saw the issue of, like we were mentioning earlier, you've got some projects that are providing the services for other projects that are providing the housing. So their costs are kind of spread across multiple agencies. So right now, the way that we understand cost effectiveness is that it's not with a very defined, you must do this or you must meet this requirement, but it's looking at your budget and basically saying, how many people are you serving with the dollars that you're given? It's not a rigorous requirement. As you can see, it's only 2 points for that whole budgeting question. And if I recall correctly from our most recent mid-year review and rank, I don't think any of the panel members had any concerns about the cost effectiveness of those projects. This is guidance language for the panel to review these projects. So it is taking a very holistic view of what exactly we're talking about when it comes to budgeting for these projects. But you're right, there is no, you know, you must have, you know, $5,000 per permanent housing exit is, quote, cost effective. There is no measure like that. And part of that is due to a lack of real clarity on what that data would look like given the way the projects are set up and designed here in Sacramento.
If I could suggest that some more specific, that just feels very loose to me. And like, I want to comply with whatever cost effective is. So if I am thinking I want to apply for a new permit supported housing program, and the average cost should be $1 per person, and I go crunch all my numbers and I can't do it for under $2 per person, then I'm not going to apply, right? But so I need more specifics as a provider on what cost-effective means. Because cost-effective for me might be different than cost-effective for John. Or
to give you a little bit of context, we had a factor where we actually were looking at the costs for all the projects, and the executive directors and program managers asked to actually pull that out of the tool so that we could do a little bit of planning around that.
Well, the committee did as well, because it was not apples and apples. It was apples
and apples. Right. And to spend some time actually like gathering data that wasn't just the COC data, but full program data, and to do kind of an in-depth study and sort of sort out the best way to look at that information. So while that wording suggests doing some similar analysis, it's really meant more to just look at, is there some kind of really outsized issue that within the budget that you're looking at? It's not necessarily meant to mean to do that similar cost analysis across all the programs.
But are they working towards? I'm sorry.
They are working towards that outside of the COC review and rank process. So that is going to go on. It will only be brought back into the ranking when everyone's comfortable that they have a better way to measure than we did at the mid-year review and rank.
Could we talk about that for a minute? Because that's a very important issue. I think we're all very concerned about demonstrating how much it costs to do what we do and have a reasonable way to do that. And I don't know where that's going to be assigned. Do we have a sense of who's going to be responsible to take the lead on doing that analysis and gathering that data?
Several of those forms will gather the data.
That would come back here, and there'd be a report back within a month or two of the initial status on that or something?
To be honest with you, John, I haven't developed a project timeline. I know we did this a couple of years ago with Focus Strategies as part of an analysis they did for us. So I need to revisit that and see how long it actually took to gather that in-depth information from all our providers and then build a timeline from there.
This is my obvious point that if it's going to be used for next year, we need to know pretty soon so we can.
So we will share the timeline here,
it was a non-sport
time. Board as we move through the milestones of the project, and once we actually have all the information, we'll work with Home Base and the Performance Review Committee to even consider what kind of metric could be attached to it.
So we go through performance review, right?
Well, I want to bring it directly here because I think it's a question of cost efficiency or cost for permanent housing exit. I think that's an issue of concern and interest to this board, and also something that will eventually become a score factor in.
But they're our committee. I mean, they have to report to us. But I mean, they'd be the committee that you'd be working with, right?
Well, I haven't even developed a timeline yet, so I'm open to your suggestions. If you think it should come here versus through the performance review committee, I mean, I was envisioning it being used in more than one place, but what is the advisory board? How would you like me to handle it?
For the purposes of today's discussion and this year's tool, the performance review committee, we talked a lot about this measure, and you know, we realize that the projects are so widely varying. We're trying this year to get full budgets for the projects so that we aren't seeing just one piece of it, which makes certain ones look very cost effective and others look not cost effective. But there is a narrative aspect to this question. And so all applicants will get the opportunity to share with us why your costs might be more expensive than other programs of similar types, and the committee will have that information on. And you know, also sharing with us how you are taking efforts to control the costs of your programs. You know, what do you look at to try and keep your costs down? And so that it is a little bit more of a subjective factor, but it seems preferable to this standard deviation methodology where we're penalizing projects that may have very valid reasons for having higher than average costs.
But we're not the only game in America. I mean, other people are looking at costs also. And I think staff's going to have to do the work, but I think performance review is the obvious place to report on the progress of the work and look at, I would think. And I don't know any other committee that would be the obvious committee for that.
They will certainly review it, but this committee is not short on weighing in, so we want to make sure.
No, back here. But it should come through the committee before it comes to the board.
Moving back to the scoring tool, page 4 is talking about these are more of your objective performance measures drawn from your HMIS through that annual performance report. You'll notice that entries from homelessness scored factor does say that we're using the definition adopted by the COC to determine that score. So this question of, you know, are projects going to be penalized if they're serving legacy clients that don't necessarily meet the current updated version of HUD's definition? The COC definition is the one that controls. So that will be used there. None of those factors otherwise have changed. They are all the same since the mid-year review and rank. Page 5. You'll see that top factor, and this is what I was talking about earlier in terms of the difference between rapid rehousing and length of stay versus exits to housing. The only change in that top factor is that the language that may, before it was a will, so now it's a permissive rather than a mandatory. Otherwise, all these factors have remained the same. There's some slight changes in terms of the wording on the scales, but they all award the same amount of points for the same outcomes. And that is the end of the renewal tool. Yes?
What is the PSH housing stability factor all one, like above? It's broken into two, so you've got the permits are transitional and the rehousing. Average length of stay is scored on its own, and then exits are scored on their own. Lumping them together kind of puts the permits at a disadvantage. For example, I had three exiters that left and lost 15 points.
Sure.
But everyone else on my program stayed for way longer than 6 months.
Sure.
So why wasn't that broken up like it is above?
Yeah, so from HUD's perspective and how we designed the tool originally, the permanent supportive housing is meant to be a permanent option. We're not necessarily looking at length of stay or trying to determine whether or not somebody is moving out quickly from permanent supportive housing, given the fact that's a more service-intensive option. HUD looks at your average length of stay for things like transitional housing, rapid rehousing, and also emergency shelter, which is not included here, and does want to see the communities are finding ways to transition people quickly out of those short-term permanent supportive or permanent housing options, right? So rapid rehousing and transitional housing, your max is 2 years. And so the scoring tool is designed to encourage projects that are operating those types of projects to find strategies to make those people as independent as possible, as quickly as possible, which aligns with HUD's overall policy priority and program design for things like transitional housing and rapid rehousing. That's also being seen now in this coming NOFA. The notice indicated there's going to be a new transitional housing, rapid rehousing hybrid project type that you can apply for that's considered a permanent supportive housing or permanent housing project type, excuse me. But again, that does come with this component of we want to exit people out as soon as possible. So that's why that scoring factor has been broken down in length of stay for the rapid rehousing and transitional housing and those exits versus permanent supportive housing, which is only asking about exits.
With the COC adopted
right.
policy. So this has been, this has been around as an adopted policy of the COC for
Yeah.
It's aligns with local and national policy.
So I guess so it's really only scoring where exiters go. And why is it weighted so heavily? This is weighted 20 points. So like three people lost 15.
Because ultimately that's the top priority of for COC funding is to exit people in permanent housing.
Mm-hmm. So that's what the Performance Review Committee has identified as our top priority, and I think this body in the past, because this scoring hasn't changed, I think, for at least a year now, that is kind of the priority of the COC to ensure that people remain in that permanent housing, hence why it has that heavy weight. Yeah.
So the other concern around the PSH housing stability measure, I think, is for small programs. So if you have a program of 12 and 2 leave, you're automatically down to 5, you only get 5 points. But yet, if you had 100 people and lost 10, you get more points. So I think we need to maybe think about weight for small programs, and maybe there's a way to kind of even that out a little bit so that small programs aren't losing more points because of percentages.
I think as with, we had a lot of discussion about this, too, at the Performance Review Committee, and we are adding, for most of the questions on this application, there will be a narrative factor added to it. And so if you have a scenario where you had an unusual case where you lost a number of people to, who knows, but you will have the opportunity to explain why that might be, and the committee can take that into account when they do the scoring of it.
And we take those narratives into consideration. I mean, we every time someone explained something and we were reviewing it, we thoughtfully considered it. So, and then there were some points where we'd look at a number or a budget and say, oh gosh, I wish they had attached a narrative to this so I could kind of understand what these numbers are saying. So when in doubt, I would say, write a narrative.
So you're saying, even though it's concrete here, it's not concrete. And that does send a little bit of a mixed message to folks in terms of like what the standard is or just do good narrative writing.
All of the scoring is kind of a guideline, correct? I mean, the committee has no obligation to score it in exactly these point categories. And we have given, like, we have split
for a project that, you know, gave an explanation, you know, that would have pushed them into a higher category. Maybe we split between 20 and 15, we'll go 17 and a half. And the committee members have the ability to make those calls.
It's still a sense if you have three people and you give a narrative and two say zero and one says five, there's still that where you thought your narrative was going to explain this away and it didn't. And it still comes down to that. It's not a computer.
You got to hire a better narrative writer.
Exactly, David. Yeah.
I mean, it's to that extent where it's what how you can empower your panel. I mean, there are communities who say on these objective factors they can't be changed, and on some of these, you know, our panel has that judgment. That's why we have a human factor, and our panel is able to read something and make changes. So, I mean, I've seen it done differently in different communities, and so it's really up to you how you've, you know, empowered your panel to make changes based on certain circumstances for programs. I mean, you may say that, like, well, if there's some kind of circumstance where they've shown that this didn't apply to them because their data was this way or that way or there was something like that, and then, you know, they just need to be able to back up the decision they've made to change it, that may be something you want to empower the panel to do. On a situation where you say, well, they're just a smaller program, so this is affecting them in a different way, I mean, that may be something where, you know, you want to talk about that's not the kind of change you want to have made, given that, you know, there are every factor is going to hit different programs different ways, you know, because we also have the issue where there are, you know, if you're serving high-needs clients, then certain things like income, it's going to be really hard for you to do. That's why there's also factors that, you know, give some points for high-needs clients. And so there is that question of if on each factor you're taking everyone's special needs into account and trying to then actually adjust for it, you do get into, then the thing becomes much more subjective, and that subjectivity is what HUD's actually trying to get away from. So, you know, there is some consideration for that and, you know, thinking about how you may or may not want to limit that.
Kathy and then Trish.
I just think if we are allowing, whether you think it's right or not, some flexibility with narratives, this should say that. Because the way that this is listed, it looks absolute. You get any of these things, there's no discretion here. And if, in fact, we are offering discretion, it's from a fairness and equity and just defensibility perspective, it should be noted on here that that's the case. Because in other cases where you can see where you get maybe 3 points, but there's some nuances in there, this looks absolute.
Well, that's how the tool was built. The tool was built so that there are certain questions where it's clear that the panel is having that sort of subjectivity, and there are some that were built where it could be pre-populated even with, you know, and you know, so it's typically then up to the community to say whether then you want to say, you know, within a point or within, you know, this or that, then there's the discretion of the panel and what that is and why, so.
But it should be noted up front.
I agree. It can be put into your policies or it can be put on the tool. Just be aware that the minutes and the tool and the policies all go to HUD during your competition. So,
will there be an area to add
Trish?
I'm going to borrow Bill's term. At the risk of sounding like I'm calling the whambulance, I just want to kind of go on record. With rapid rehousing, I know several of the programs we all have, you know, various issues. And with respect to the fact that the new COC targets were announced and implemented roughly July of last year, the fact that our, you know, some of our programs were full by that point, clients were told, you're going to be in this for 24 months. So changing the guidelines, changing the goals midstream is difficult to sit in front of a group of clients and say, I know that 6 months ago we told you you've got two years we're going to work with you, but guess what? We now need to get rid of you in 90 days. That's our target, you know. So we've, not that we've really said it that way, but I do encourage the Performance Review Committee to take the narrative seriously on especially these types of things, because the game changed midstream. We are working with SSF on the fact that
potentially referrals were made into this program inappropriately and people aren't going to be successful in some of the rapid rehousing. Some of the referrals that were made were not appropriate for true rapid rehousing based on a variety of factors. So I just encourage that that narratives are taken into consideration for this round, because it looks like all three of our key programs in rapid rehousing have various issues of that name.
Thank you.
So.
Yeah, I just want to express appreciation, I think all of us feel, for doing the mid-year review.
Yeah.
We've never done it before. It's been extraordinarily helpful to have a chance to walk through this when it didn't count and kind of see how it came out and have a chance to have feedback. As you probably know, the executive directors decided on their own at a meeting when we heard this to meet a second time. This is decided by the executive directors, where they would sort of, hey, I'll show you mine if you'll show me yours kind of thing, and really take a look at everything. This was entirely the executive director deciding to do that. And so we had a chance to look at all the data together and think about things that weren't working out or things that were working out. That would have never been an opportunity if you hadn't been able to put together the major review and do that. So I really appreciate Michelle's work and everyone's work to make that happen. The
I'll
obvious
second that.
Point I want to make now, though, is that when I look at the way that resulted, suddenly we're not going to provide any funding for Mercy Housing when the real thing happens, if it's going to score anything like this. We're not going to have Boulevard Court. We're not going to have MLK. What's wrong with this picture, right? I mean, do we have other ways to fund those spots, or what are we doing wrong? We think those are very appropriate places for HUD to be funding, and yet the way we've designed this tool looks like is going to say there's no way you're going to get funding. What's that tell us?
And if I could add on that, permanent supportive housing, site-based, has to have some consideration. It is so hard to put together. It takes so long. It's a priority of everybody.
Yep.
Investors won't come. Developers won't come, et cetera, if the money is like that.
Yep.
And so I completely agree. Like, they have to have a different consideration for site-based projects somehow.
So I just, on behalf of Catherine, Sarah, Pipe, I think we had all of these exact concerns when we saw the ranking. That was one of the first things, that addition to the wraparound house. And I think that I would appreciate any guidance from this committee, because we struggled with both ends. So like what Susie was describing of like making sure that projects that are unique or different are considered, we could end up with 20 different rubrics and every project is competing against itself. Or we could end up with one where it's either super objective, and if you're small or you're something different, then oh well, or super, super subjective, and none of those things sort of work together very well. And I would appreciate guidance from the advisory board about how you would like us to address those competing interests. We went into this last year for sure with the goal of being as objective as possible. We don't have all the data that we would like to have to allow us to have apples-to-apples comparisons, so we're sort of teetering in between using data that we know isn't comparable and making you an apple, everybody an apple, or being super subjective and lending ourselves to the whims of who's the best writer or who has the biggest, most long-standing project and just happens to be really good at NOFA competitions. And so I hear all of, and we've had all these discussions, and I think that I know I, for one, feel that a lot of this is developed under time pressure, and that is nothing any of us can do. It's no fault. It's HUD, the way HUD works. And we have to have something ready to go. But I also hear the concerns, very valid concerns, of our providers of saying, are we approving something and moving forward just because of the time scare? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what to stop. Any guidance?
Yeah.
Would be really appreciated, because we're the ones those other committee members who aren't here. And I think we can see we all had similar concerns.
I think this discussion is sobering, but it also points out the very difficult position that this board has, where we have funded agencies, those who will be judged, trying to figure out a judging tool, and the inherent difficulties of that are abundantly clear every time we have a discussion. the funded agencies are the area experts. They know how it works in the real world. But it's a very bad dynamic to have the people who will be judged having to make the decision of how you're judged, because of course they are thinking of the very people in their programs who will be affected. We have tried very hard to achieve objectivity in our scoring tool, and we should not forget why objectivity is a good thing. Otherwise, you have a very unclear process subject to pressures that shouldn't be there. I would like to hear from Michelle on the time urgency. Is this something that we can put over till next month and ask the Performance Review Committee to review all the input from today and make a strong recommendation next month?
Well, it is a little bit uncertain as to when the NOFA will be released yet, but we have been advised that it could be as early as the end of this month, which is where the urgency is coming from. However, we do know there is one item within this tool that will be discussed at your meeting next month, no matter what, because it's pending. I think if this board could, if we could be just really clear and limit how much change, we're not reopening the entire thing, putting some guidance around that could be helpful to bring something specific back to you, and then next month, and then I'll ask Home Base if they have any new info or any additional advice since they do this in multiple.
Well, I think for me, the evident low scoring that site-based programs get, I don't know exactly where that is in the scoring tool, but it just looks like there must be some way that we're penalizing those programs and not allowing them to get points that other... I mean, I score higher every time, right? So I mean, I'm sort of unhappy with the way you describe that because I'm not advocating for my program, right?
Right.
You understand that?
I do.
I'm advocating for the people I know who are living in MLK Village, and we're talking about not being able to continue to support them, which means I'm advocating for having MLK Village, which in a sense can't even be built in the first place unless they can show they've got this this way to fund some of their units. Mm-hmm. And I want to have more MLK Villages, and I'm never going to build one myself. It's nothing to do with me. Right? And, you know, and there's something about... As far as I know, HUD is totally okay with doing that. It's not like we're not following HUD guidelines if we find a way to support that, right? So that somehow we have, you know, skewed this to penalize programs that HUD is okay with. So I think we're sort of, so it's nothing to do with objectivity. It's sort of just in by inadvertence or something.
Point well taken. Any other feedback specifically?
I think the only other thing is I think the gaps analysis will provide lots of guidance. I'm hoping that the gaps analysis will say clearly we cannot lose site-based permanent supportive housing. I mean, because we have no housing, so if we lose site-based, we lose everything. I mean, so I would hope that the gaps analysis will show us that, but right now it's kind of unknown.
In the interest of narrowing what comes mm-hmm. back, I've heard certainly how can we look at permanent support, existing site base, whether it's through the gaps, that's, or something more direct, like points for site based projects. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I mean, that's right. Sometimes goes against what you're trying to do, but if the committee could maybe come back with that, that's one thing I heard. Is it? The other area I heard, maybe people heard more, was these two objective. Sarah clearly said it has narrative, it's subjective. I also heard it's objective. So which is it would be helpful as we vote, and which should it be? I don't know if we just say try again or tell us more or something. I don't know if people have comments more on how to make this objective work, given the history of changes, given some complexity. Maybe you have to go to subjective, or are there suggestions on, no, it's just not quite right in terms of the objective factor.
just had a request, and you kind of say, like, explain it in the narrative, but in the past, we haven't always had the opportunity to write the narratives. You just get kind of the narrative of explaining your program.
As we talked about it, the two meetings, we're building it out so there's an opportunity for each thing to add some narrative. So I think sounds like the clarification needs to be, what the panel can do in terms of, can they change the one scaled scores, and how that's going to work and where we put that if they are able to.
Point of order, we're losing non-conflicted members who can vote on this. I mean, we're down to a handful. So I don't know procedurally how comfortable you guys feeling with a vote of it'll be five people when I'm just worried about that.
Right, that's a good point.
We haven't gone over the new tool.
Right.
Yeah.
And we are over time, so I think we are not in a position to take the vote today. And I want to thank the committee members and home base for their very clear presentation and for everyone for the participation. And basically, we're referring this back to committee and staff and be prepared to take action next month.
Would it be helpful to have some sense of whether we want objective or subjective?
Yes, that would be very helpful.
That would be, yes.
Please tell us. We want to be able to adjust.
I heard Joan say, we were moving to objective. I've heard. So I actually like objective, but I understand the complexity of things change. So I'm not helpful in that. But maybe other people can be helpful.
Patty?
I don't know if the committee chair of the committee would be open for this, but perhaps let everybody know when the committee meets. So if you want to attend a meeting and have more input, I just am noting that our next meeting, we have tentatively invited Mayor Steinberg, which means we're thrown into the same situation where we're going to be rushed at the end of the meeting to conduct the business that we need to conduct, because I guarantee you he will not be finished in 10 minutes. So I just kind of looking at that, and if we've invited him, I know we don't want to say, excuse me, we have to do something else, or maybe we want to say that meeting will last longer than, go ahead and say right now it's going to be a longer meeting, but let's talk about ways can people attend the committee meeting and work some of this discussion out at that meeting. Can we extend our meeting in June? But I would hate to be sitting here a month from now still not having looked at the new scoring tool, because we're still having discussions, and quite frankly, from the questions that have come up, it's small points, but they're points we need to get through. Excellent suggestion, Patty.
We can pull around back with the mayor's office, see if it's been confirmed, mm-hmm. and then we'll give ample time for this discussion at next meeting, if we have to extend to time.
And I just, Michelle, I don't see on my calendar the performance review committee meeting. Do we have one before the next?
Yeah, June 7th.
First Wednesday. Wednesday,
which is the same. Oh, this means the second Wednesday.
At what time?
2 to 3:30.
Here, in this room.
Yes.
Can I just make a recommendation? I feel so troubled and concerned here, because I'm not clear what our objective really is. Is our goal, and it could be numerous objectives, and I'm not necessarily fighting for a specific one, but is our goal to try to keep as many beds for permanent housing as possible in our community? Is our goal to fund only the highest performers? Is our goal to be a high-performing community? I don't know what our goal is, and maybe you do, and maybe I'm the only one who doesn't. But it seems to me that if we had some guiding principles, we could move all of this towards those. So to say objective or not objective, that seems like the cart before the horse. It seems to me that we need to know where we're going before we figure out how we're going to get there. So I just want to suggest that we maybe take just a quick step back and take a look at what is our ultimate goal, and then try to align these processes and tools with that.
I mean, I think for me, sitting on the committee, one of my thoughts is how do all the excellent programs in this room work together to serve the clients that are in this region, and what are those clients' needs? So the gaps analysis, for me, is super key to that, as far as, you know, what are the needs in this region? Do we need one more of one type of something versus another type, another housing? You know, what do we need, and how can all the cogs in this machine work together in a system to provide that for the region? And so that analysis, at least for me personally, is key. And I think that's one of the main objectives that we all need to work towards together in this process.
I think one thing I would add, just to, in terms of the actual review and rank process itself, in terms of maintaining as much of your COC funding as necessary, you have to do performance-based ranking. And HUD has been really clear about that and has, you know, moved towards that more and more each year. And so I think it's really important that you do that and you're able to demonstrate that you do that.
Well, then let's lead with that. I mean, let's put that at the top. I mean, I don't know if that's all there is, but let's just be sure that, because we get, you know, all kinds of conversations going on here, and I think we lose sight of, if that's the answer, we lose sight of that answer.
I'm not saying it's the only answer. I'm just saying that, like, from a...
I'm just saying yes, yes, and let's continue that.
I would just add that let our goal be more grand than just the HUD app. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's the larger conversation that I think needs to be had and defined for the purpose of this application. What was just stated, I think, is our goal. But we shouldn't just end our community conversation at that.
Right. So then the broader goal is, you know, what Catherine named and what the, you know, executive directors got together and started to do, which is really the more, you know, the more important broader goal. It's just
private investors.
So I love that you said that, and that what we're doing here is a reflective of that, in my view.
And we have time for one more question and or comment, Mike, and then Cindy, two more. And then because we are over time, we need to bring this to a close.
Just in terms of what our objective is, it is so patently obvious that we have 3,500 PSH and rapid rehousing slots or something like that, and we have 1,000 people in shelters and at least 1,000 people in the bushes. So we're at least 2,000 permanent supportive housing units short. Unquestionable. Lots of details about what kind, mix, project design, etc. We don't want to lose any project, any of the existing PSAs we've got. And this tool is not properly reflecting project base, as Cindy said. Is fundamentally got to be designed to protect those, period. Otherwise, we're losing ground, not gaining ground.
Cindy, I just kind of want to do a little reality check on the gaps analysis, because I can almost guarantee it will be a lot to talk about. I don't know how much has been shared. It's a hard thing to do. There's a lot of assumptions into it. It will have as much complication as any of this. And so I think it's absolutely the need and the right direction, but I think for this round, let's just be a little cautious about what it might bring. And can you, is there work being done between here and when you do present that, that folks can participate in if you want them, if they want to? Is there any viewing of it? Is there any feedback? So by the time it gets here, you know, there's some vetting or comfort.
Yeah, we can. I'm supposed to.
Think about that, Michelle.
I will we'll pull something together, like a separate convening of some kind to get some feedback ahead of the 14th of June. There's some window in there that the analysis should be provided for this group to begin.
Thank you.
For the review committee, it was suggested that some of us come to give input at your next meeting. Is that something that is helpful for you guys, or is this something that you guys, you know, are going to have not a closed meeting, but a meeting to hash all this out? Are we being helpful by being there, I guess is my question. Because we're the same as we are now. I'm concerned, I guess.
Yeah, one of the things we haven't established, so in general, those meetings are not, I don't know if they're closed, they're not open like these. Mm-hmm. So we don't have And we have yet to establish the formal procedures of, like, who's the chair. We don't have a chair. We don't have, so I guess I would look to Michelle or Ryan to say, I mean, I think that it would be this discussion, and then our hour and a half would be.
That was my feeling as well, but it was suggested. I just wanted to make sure that we had.
Maybe as a way to submit stuff, or I don't know how to.
It is a closed meeting, and it was talked about at the last convening of the policy procedures that are being developed towards that goal. It's clear that that has to be in place, and so that's being completed.
And who is on that committee?
Off the top of my head.
I know the three of you.
Three of us.
Me, Jeff Ross from SHRA.
So there's three conflicted members. Jeff,
yeah, Carol is on
Carolyn, and Carol are the three conflicted members. Then other non-conflicted.
We have Artie.
Artie from the school district.
Arturo from.
Arturo from
Sac State.
Yeah. What's her name? Barbara from the Stand Down.
Yes.
And there's a woman with the blonde hat.
The Cal Abel, Christina.
Christina.
Where's she from?
Cal Abel.
Yeah, a state level disability. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So for the committee meeting, can there be an open input and then a closed committee meeting?
I don't know. But we don't have any.
Because we've almost done that here.
Yes, you have. And we hear, you know, very similar feedback from the providers that are on the committee, from the conflicted members on the committee have provided similar feedback. It might be helpful if you have comments for the committee to do those in writing and email them to Michelle and Brian, and then we can kind of, the more time we have to review things before the meeting and think about them, the more rich the discussion is at the meeting.
And I'd say especially some of these sort of bigger, not necessarily like question number eight should be reworded, like, and this is fine, but the bigger things of like how to address, you know, any recommendations you have on to address like dissimilar project types being judged against each other, or the objective-subjective conversation, mm-hmm. things like that would be really helpful, because those are the things that we struggle with the most as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then also we didn't do any of the new project scoring tools, so you know, be sure and give them input on that.
Yes.
Is there a possibility that you could meet more regularly rather than just once a month
this time?
All of them. I don't know. I just feel like once a month is just it's lagging, and 1.5 hours once a month is not enough time. Maybe we could do every 2 weeks or something. Just to be able to get more done.
Suggestion to consider. At this point, I want to thank everyone for the discussion this morning and meeting adjourned.
Michelle, say one thing.
Okay.
I just want to remind everyone that I think we need to do this additional work. It makes sense. The notebook could drop between now and the next meeting. If it does, then we'll officially be online to schedule. I guess just keep all of that in mind and just trust that'll make the next meeting really But we're working toward a point where this stuff is getting approved much sooner.
Yeah, this is
well.
On meetings like that, perhaps we in advance try to schedule them a little longer so that if people know, it might take till 10, they can try to plan accordingly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Good, how are you?
Good to see you. I haven't seen you forever, John. Where are you been?
Well, because every single time there's a meeting, I have to go to work.
From Prince or Alex.
I'm trying to figure out how to get more people in.
list, like, people that are on the table.
So that's...
We need the other people that... And it's such a small list.
Exactly. So it's like we're missing... You know, we're missing everybody.
I guess we just have the opposite issue. Pretty most everyone
Well, and it's I think that will help when we have that because of every project
we're
So that will get us better
Well, at least we have a starting point.
Yeah, and like, we know we can run it.
Well, we're starting the case canvassing, so we're meeting, alternating. So we have that meeting that Genevieve appointed for us to catch the. Yeah, so at the end of the month, we're going to add the case conferencing board and bring in the group of case managers. And then we'll go through the list. But then as we go, we'll add people. Okay, like we change the
Yeah.
I just need to make this a Because they're not any
I'm going to go to the next one.
Three names.
I think you're going to be in there.
I think that's a good one. Coordinated entry system.
Change it for everybody, and
For something that relates to
Well, let's talk about faster.
Yeah, nice to meet you. HUD's policies.
Because I thought about it, I brought my helping handbag.
So that they're saying, you know, we tell our programmers.
Oh, yes. That would be.
Which is true, I would rather say. But HUD never really thought that that would be.
I got my first idea.
You're willing to exit people out of rapid housing from a permanent position. You know, still in the same apartment, but no longer receiving support. And so, so now they're in a position where they've told their clients one thing, now they have to start back up. It's also because HUD is now starting to put a little pressure on. Because before, when they first introduced pressure on housing, HUD was like,
well, it's time, you know, whatever,
just take the time, you want to stabilize all kinds of stuff, you know, harm reduction approach. And now with the system's performance measures, they're starting to ask, well, how long have people been?
There are some factors like that.
And, you know, they're not going to compare to other communities across the country. They are going to have some career, you demonstrate that you're making that number lower. And that was never kind of the first part of the deal, so to speak, until the first acceptance. So, you know, it's the same thing with HUD that. Yeah. But it's also, you know, it's also now becoming a problem in terms of permanent support housing projects, where there's a lot of folks that might potentially be able to be self-sustaining and be independent. But there isn't a clear track on how to graduate these people out of permanent support housing. And all of the conferences I've been going to with the HUD folks is that they're all kind of starting to talk about this language and go like, well, how do you get people to graduate?
And I have them, I say, I'm going to make talks about this.
And it's kind of like you heard this talent is kind of like said that, you know, when it comes to my veteran folks, a lot of them are at that field, like we want to open this up for other veterans to explore. And it's kind of like, how do you create that kind of support?
And I mean, honestly, I'd be comfortable just giving you my own expression, but I think that that's...
Yeah. Well, and it's also, you know, HUD unfortunately comes in with a hammer to try to deal with something.
It is. And I told them all that.
Not a hammer, but a feather to deal with. In terms of, you know, you're going to have some folks who really do need to, who are, you know, permanently disabled. They're never going to be able to be independent. But you're going to have other folks who probably could move out quickly if they had those structures in place. But HUD's metric is just asking overall, what are your numbers? And if you're not decreasing those numbers, then you're going to be penalized. Another good example of this is the dedication of housing units to provide homeless individuals. Some COCs have said, look, all of our COC funded beds are dedicated to chronically homeless and are in fact filled by chronically homeless. So we can't increase that number on the COC application. But if we don't increase it, we get hit in terms of that score. And HUD just said, well, find other people a little different.
But is there the potential to kind of like stratify in terms of folks that, you know, do look as though they're capable of moving towards self-sufficiency, employment, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is that opportunity there, but you do have to work with your providers and get them to understand and embrace that philosophy of you really do need to try to find ways to get people self-sufficient, and every time you start that conversation, there's a lot of pushback. Because they say, well, but, you know, our people are so disabled, they're never going to be independent,
just feels
all this.
Like,
but, you know, but then I talked to providers, I was like, yeah, we've had, you know, Johnson Smith project for 6 years, and he's just now able to graduate. So some of that, I think, hesitance about trying to graduate people at PSH is because we are really looking at a 5 to 10 year timeline for a lot of folks. So, you know, and that's kind of something that hasn't really been looked at in terms of
where we can bring that back in.
So, yeah.
For me, something that I've had like the most familiar, it's kind of like this compensated work therapy program that talked about. There are conditions on it in terms of you have to be searching for work and show that you're searching for work and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's because we already have a hard enough time getting through.
You might not kind of like show you that in terms of like the conditions I'm kind of like thinking about in terms of what if you applied that kind of those kinds of conditions for us.
Yeah, so that's, you know, we were talking about housing first a little bit earlier, right? HUD really doesn't want to say, you know, the way I kind of tell it to people is if you're using housing to compel or restrict behavior, HUD's not going to like that because that's going against the whole housing first model. So if you're trying to say to somebody, you know, we're going to no longer provide you with this housing voucher or this placement unless you do X, Y, and Z, that's going to run against HUD's housing first policies. And so, you know, I think there might be an interesting discussion of, you know, do we want to bring back some of those requirements at a certain point in time? Are there threshold conditions where you can say that that's no longer a source of harm for individuals? How does that look? I don't know. And that's something that is still being, I think, researched and developed in a lot of the literature.
It seems to me that that's the direction that the country is going.
Yeah. Well, especially with the new Secretary Carson. We're going to start to see some of those things come. So, yeah.
think so.
And I think, you know, what I want to see is I do think that folks who are exiting directly from the street, try and tell them, you have to be clean.
At the very beginning of a meeting, there's like general public comment.
You know, they're trying to get over the trauma of just being out there for 10, 13, 15 years. But I do think there is a room for discussion. Okay, so now they're stabilized, they're doing okay, they're on their meds, they're going to their doctors, you know, for a year or two or 3 years, we know they're going to go. At what point in time do we start saying, well, we need to kind of help encourage you to move on and not be, you know, too rooted here and find ways to grow and become independent? And is that, you know, through mandatory service requirements? Is that through, what does that really look like in terms of service delivery? And I think that, you know, it's a discussion that nobody's really having because most people are still at that first step of, but I don't really